This is the Unconquered Podcast. Unbiased, unrivaled, and unconquered coverage and analysis of Florida State football.
In Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys getting a little banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something, I can really do this.
Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Today on the show, we'll talk about a few changes to look for on offense this year. We'll assess realistic expectations for the 2013 season, and we will talk about the legend of Jimbo Fisher, underachiever. All right, let's get started. As far as changes on offense this year, obviously the transition from EJ Manuel to Jameis Winston is going to produce some differences just in itself. Each quarterback has different strengths. Winston runs well, but maybe not quite as naturally as EJ did, although it appears that he will be a much more willing runner than EJ was as a senior. But the bigger thing is that Winston seems to throw a little bit more comfortably and more readily downfield, and that's one change that I think we're going to see right away, right off the bat. We're going to see a lot more aggressive play action and downfield throwing game, or the passing game, is going to be much more aggressive, I think, this year than what Florida State fans saw last year. The main thing is that Winston really is comfortable trying to push the ball downfield. One thing that I saw a lot of in the spring game that I saw almost none of last year was the four verticals concept. So basically, you line up four guys on the, four different receivers, on the line of scrimmage. It might be two tight ends, two receivers. It might be four wide receivers. Could be any number of combinations. And then you essentially release all of them vertically up the field. And then essentially you let the quarterback read the safeties, read the coverage, and determine which guy, which vertical route he's gonna hit. That actually was the route that was called on the first play for Winston that scored against LaMarcus Joyner in the spring game. That was the other touchdown pass on the back shoulder throw was a very similar concept to that. And that back shoulder throw on there actually tells you a little bit about the flexibility that a four-vert concept allows you. You don't just send four guys to run straight downfield. Those guys actually have to read the coverage a little bit as well. So, if it's a two safety look, then one of the verticals is gonna angle a little bit inside to take that seam inside the two safeties. If you've got a quarters look, then you're gonna see a little bit different combination than what you're gonna see against cover three. Usually, what you're gonna see is you're gonna see one of those guys try to take the coverage with him a little bit, and there'll be some idea of where to go based on matchups. And one thing that I think we'll see a lot more of this year, as a result of actually both quarterbacks throw it awfully well, both Winston and Coker throw this very well, is that back shoulder fade or back shoulder takeoff throw up the sideline on this kind of concept. It's something that you really saw almost nothing of the last few years, but both quarterbacks throw it really well. And again, on that kind of four verticals concept, one of the things that you can tag or you can add to it is, or you can just make it a read depending on the week. There's all sorts of things you can do with it. But one of the things that you can do is have one of those receivers who's going to run that back shoulder fade, or you can coach it so that depending on the coverage, if the coverage is even with you, then the quarterback's going to just throw that back shoulder route. Which tends to be the way that Fisher actually tends to coach that. He tends to coach it such that if the receiver is able to get over the top, then you throw it over the top. If they're even, then you throw that back shoulder. And that's what you saw a few times in the spring game out of these more vertical concepts. It's something you saw from Texas A&M quite a bit last year against Alabama, against their tight coverage. You did see Alabama do it a little bit, but not quite as much with Amari Cooper. What I really am expecting is that kind of vertical game, though, right off the bat. I wouldn't be surprised if against Pitt, because Pitt has such a good defensive line and a good front seven, if Florida State comes out throwing play action vertical pretty quickly just to establish how well Winston throws downfield, how much he can challenge you over the top and to the edges. At any rate, that's the first thing that I think we're going to see different this year from last year. Last year's passing game was really conservative. It was a very conservative passing game. And that was not really so much a mark of Jimbo Fisher as a coordinator as Jimbo Fisher coordinating an offense that was most comfortable for EJ Manuel to execute. And that's a distinction that's an important one to make, because Fisher has in the past been a very, very aggressive offensive coordinator when he's had the kind of quarterback that is comfortable in that kind of offense. He's very flexible in the kind of attack that he will that he will call depending on who he's got under center. So that's the first thing. I expect to see that. And that one of the other reasons that I expect to see a lot of that is because this team will be more run heavy just by the nature of how good this offensive line should be and how good and how big the backs are. In particular, James Wilder Jr. Has finally gotten, I've been saying for a couple years now that I felt like he would be a much better back at the, 235 range rather than the 225 range, and he's right in that range at this point. He's primed for I think a terrific season, and having that kind of power threat, what that allows you to do is do more play action down the field because people have to commit a little bit more to that, to stopping that run game. And in terms of the run game, I think a lot of people are expecting there to be a very different run game this year. There will be some differences. In the offseason, the coaching staff did go back and do some self-evaluation especially when the new guys arrived. There was some evaluation of ways to produce better results, in particular in short yardage and in power situations. That's where you're going to see more jumbo looks. You're going to see more gap blocking and more trap stuff and power O in situations where you need to make that play up inside the tackles. And I think we will see a little bit more inside zone. So essentially more of a vertical running game this year than what we've seen in the past. I expect that, to go hand in glove with, more of that vertical passing game, because that establishes that straight drop in the play action to allow the quarterback to set up behind play action and throw downfield. So all these packages sort of go together. Now, that does not mean that Florida State will stop being an outside zone, a primarily outside zone team. I mean, that is what they are. That's the way that Rick Trickett starts that's the first thing they install in camp. That's the bread and butter play. I mean, Miami has their bread and butter, 15 week inside, inside zone, what they call Wyoming. That's what they do. Alabama runs a lot of inside zone as their bread and butter. Florida State has taken the kind of Alex Gibbs approach. Alex Gibbs being the famed offensive line coach for Mike Shanahan out in Denver when Terrell Davis was out there, when they kept manufacturing all those 1,000-yard rushers. He also, I believe, spent some time with the Texans when they were pushing out 1,000 yard rushers as well. So basically, Trickett has applied the Alex Gibbs methodology to zone blocking schemes, which starts with the outside zone as the primary. Now, that sounds like it might be more of a finesse approach, but that's not really true. What it does is the point of starting with that outside zone is the outside zone creates bigger seams for cutbacks because you get more movement on the line. Actually, I've heard Al Golden in a coaching clinic. He talked about how the play action to the outside zone action was just elephants on parade. I mean, you're getting a lot of movement up front. And as a result, when you get that kind of movement, if you've got some guys that are physical up front, that creates big seams. And ideally what you want, you in the outside zone, you actually don't typically want that outside zone to get stretched to the outside. That's a signal that your offensive line didn't play it physically enough. You weren't able to get that kind of seam built that you want. What you're really looking for, and if you go back to the old Terrell Davis days when he was back with Denver, with those 2,000-yard rushing seasons and all that, those were almost all on outside zone runs. But what he would do, you know, you start the whole point with the outside zone is you start with the target of the running back being basically the tackle. You know, you're running to the outside shoulder of the tackle, or, you know, some teach it with the outside leg of the tight end, whether there's a tight end there or not. That's where you start your run as the tailback, and the offensive line sort of all goes in that direction. But then what the whole point is to get everybody moving in that direction so that the running back can plant his foot in the ground once, and then cut back straight against the grain so that you're able to get a running back with a lot of head of steam and just a ton of power cutting back against the grain, again, you know, against a defense that's not moving in the right direction to be able to take that power. So, I mean, it's the kind of setup that can really work well if you run it with power. You've got to have the personnel to run it with power, and I think Florida State does. But that's why you do it. It's not really a finesse play if you block it right and if you have power personnel. That said, I do expect to see more inside zone this year than we've seen the last couple of years. I do expect in particular to see more power O. And what that is the center and the guard block down. They block to the opposite side of the play, and you're going to get an offensive lineman pulling through the hole, leading the tailback through the hole, so that those play side players who are down blocking have leverage, and then that extra offensive lineman coming through the hole has the ability to hopefully clear that hole for the running back. I think we'll see more of that this year than what we saw last year. You started to see it a little bit toward the tail end of the year. It's something that Florida State gashed South Carolina on in the Chick-fil-A Bowl a couple years ago. It's something that's there, but I think that Florida State now has the personnel to really run that the way that they want to, and they haven't really had that. And, you know, last year the primary back that was going to be featured was Chris Thompson, and who was pretty much the ideal fast cutback runner for the outside zone. He read the outside zone as well as anybody probably in college football last year before his injury. Whereas this year, you've got guys who haven't shown quite as good of a propensity to read that outside zone perfectly, but have a little more power. And in those short yardage situations, I expect to see a little bit more of that power O, a little bit more gap blocking, you know, down blocking, so that you're producing that leverage in the short yardage game. That's where you're going to see some differences in the running game. Another thing that I, you know, in terms of differences, and this is going to affect both the run and the pass, is I do expect more pistol type stuff this year. There are a couple reasons for that. One is, again, you've got backs with both Devontae Freeman and James Wilder Jr. who run a little bit better when they're moving toward the line of scrimmage, when they have a little bit of head of steam than they do when they're coming out of the shotgun. So, you know, I expect to see a little bit more of the kind of pistol look where you can still use the kind of gun passing game and the advantages of the shotgun while you're still getting some of the advantages of your standard under center running game. So I expect to see some of that. The other reason that I expect to see that is because of Jameis Winston's ability in the run game. One thing that EJ Manuel did very poorly last year was, there's all sorts of speculation as to why, but regardless, he did not run the zone read well at all last year. It's one of the reasons that they ran it so little last year is because he made the wrong read more often than not, and by a high percentage. So what I expect to see this year is, you know, both Winston and Coker, but Winston in particular runs that zone read pretty naturally. We'll see more of that kind of action with Winston than what we did with Manuel, because he's more comfortable doing it. I'm not sure that we'll see the same amount of option stuff, of true pitch option, you know, speed option stuff that you saw with Manuel, because Manuel was extremely natural doing that sort of thing. But I do think we'll see more of a zone read type game, more of the quarterback making the read on the handoff, and some 11-man run game. And one of the things that actually should be slightly concerning for Florida State fans is that, you know, I was told recently that the quarterbacks are not really – neither quarterback is really ready at the standard that they need to be at this point in the season, going into the season, in order to be really successful. That as we had some discussion, we had an article up on Noll Digest for the premium side, talking about how neither quarterback has really done a terrific job or was doing a terrific job, at least early in camp, recognizing and assessing the blitz. It's gotten a little bit better, but they're still a little ways away from where they need to be there. And one way that you can neutralize the blitz, as has been shown in the NFL just recently, much to the consternation of NFL defensive coordinators, is that if you can have that quarterback as a run threat, then your blitzes have to be more sound because you don't have as many guys on that second level in pursuit. If the quarterback's able to escape the pocket, then you're in trouble because he can really gash you. So that's one of the things that I actually do expect, especially early. What we'll see against Pitt is some play action, and we'll see some 11-man run game. Even though as good as Florida State should be in the regular, you know, in just with the tailbacks, I think we're going to see initially Winston's legs used as a way to limit coverage, not so much to get him out to get him running, you know, to run. They're not going to run Winston for 1,000 yards like what Johnny Manziel did last year for Texas A&M. That's just not the way that Fisher wants to do it, especially, you know, with the history of quarterbacks getting hurt. Florida State's not had the best record with that in the last few years. Fisher really doesn't want to take those risks. But what he does want to do is limit the coverages that people can throw at the young quarterbacks. And one way to do that is to present the threat in the run game with the quarterback, in particular off of those zone reads and those naked boots and things like that. Because if you blitz off of that, if you blitz that zone read and the quarterback's able to make a play, then you're missing that linebacker, that safety or more that you brought in at the second level, and it can really turn out poorly. You know, you end up not having the gap control that you need, so and not having that secondary support that you need. So I expect to see a lot of that. Just basically using, anytime teams start to blitz, anytime teams start to do that. You saw this with Christian Ponder in 2008. You saw some calls in the 11-man run game, involving the quarterback in the run game to basically neutralize the defense, to get the defense to play more vanilla. And another way to do that, by the way, is simply to tell Winston, okay, if you see this blitz, if you see this, then look at your first option. But if it's not there, just take off. You don't necessarily have to call anything. It can be an uncalled quarterback draw, effectively. And if Winston understands what look he's seeing, then that can really turn out well. Because again, you're using that threat of the quarterback run to minimize the kinds of looks that they're going to do, because they're much less likely to bring that in the future if that's just going to mean the quarterback's going to get out of the pocket. That means that you're going to end up getting you're more likely to get a spy put on the quarterback than you are heavy blitz pressure, that sort of thing, which is great because a spy in many cases takes a guy more or less out of coverage and doesn't really affect you the same way in pressure. So that's really what I think that you're going to see early in the year in terms of some changes to look for on offense this year. All right, now we'll move to the second part of the show where we're going to assess what realistic expectations for 2013 actually look like for Florida State. And to help us do that, we're now going to be joined by Steve Pointer of SimplifiedFootball.com, who's going to tell us a little bit about what to expect, not just for Florida State, but nationally, based on power ratings that he's been assembling using relative talent levels and experience levels and some data about prior seasons for how teams of various talent and experience levels and the gaps between those talent and experience levels for prior games have fared against one another in previous seasons. So thanks for joining us on the program, Steve.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. First, can you tell us a little bit about your methodology, how you've determined what reasonable win percentages would actually be for various teams and so on, and how you've actually gone about some of this stuff?
Okay. Sure, no problem. basically, I've given each school a rating based on their caliber of players they have brought in, as well as the experience that those players have. And I compared those ratings that I've compiled with that of other teams on each team's schedule. And basically just goes through, you know, how many years each kid has been in school and how many starts he's had and stuff like that. And just found the correlation between the talent level of each team and how often they win. And I've compiled those stats for 2011 and 2012 pretty much. And just compiled a sliding scale of each team's chances of winning based on their talent level, their experience, and their opponent that they have played in their opponent's talent levels. Then coming towards through 2013, I've compared those the numbers for each team with the teams based on that are on their schedule, and came up with a win share for each team based on their level of talent.
Okay, so when you're talking about prior years, so have you been I take it that what that means is essentially you've got a spreadsheet where you've looked at prior games between teams of the same relative talent level that you're looking at, and you're basically projecting on the basis of percentages of how teams with that basic gap has fared in the past. Is that about right?
Correct. Yeah, I've got a spreadsheet based on, you know, for especially 2012 and 2011, and each team's rating for those years and who they played in those years, and just come up with a percentage of what we can expect.
Okay, so this is, I mean, and in terms of your understanding of how these teams, you know, talent ratings work and so on, I'm assuming this is only based on the players currently on the roster, and, you know, is there some objective way of measuring talent, or, you know, how are you going about that exactly?
Yeah, it's just the players on the current roster, and I've pretty much done away. I've looked at each current rosters and gotten rid of players that either left school for the NFL or were kicked out of school or anything like that, and I've got it just to their current roster and basically just used different ratings, scout ratings for those teams, and use those levels that we've seen with what scouts have rated them coming in.
Okay, so essentially just looking at the basic talent level thought by scouts when these guys are coming out of high school. So that makes some sense. Of course, there is the problem of, you know, certain guys, if they're recruited by certain schools, their ratings do go up and all of that. Which actually, I guess one of the interesting things about this is that it gives an opportunity to see maybe which schools do a little bit more with less, or, you know, maybe certain kids are overrated because they're going to a given school or because they were recruited by a different school. So, you know, that it's going to be interesting, I guess, to see over the next couple of years how all this pans out, to see those correlations. So let's move on just a little bit and let's talk about, you know, what are some surprises that you found so far in going through these ratings? Are there teams that may be a little under the radar or maybe a little overrated because of, you know, one factor or another that your particular approach has sort of flagged?
Yeah, there's a lot of surprises, actually. You know, teams like Auburn and California that haven't performed quite well in recent seasons for whatever reason, I found that their talent levels are actually quite on par with other teams that they play on their schedule or above other teams. I've also found Washington has quite high talent levels, as does Rutgers, actually. Rutgers' talent level is actually on the level of many SEC teams. And also, you know, for the ACC, one thing I found was Pitt's defense actually has a lot higher talent level than one would think based on what they've seen on TV or what they have seen in, like, Pitt's win-loss record.
Yeah, it's, well, that may actually explain a little bit about how they looked against Notre Dame last year when they got a little inspired. So, you know, that does seem to go along with at least some of the results.
Correct. So specifically with those teams, I'd really look out for Washington and Auburn this year to do better than many pundits would say they would do. And also on the flip side, three teams that I've seen that are a lot lower with their talent levels than one would think are Kansas State, South Carolina, and Clemson, really. You know, Clemson. You see them, Clemson. Yeah, you know, you would see, you know, many people are expecting them to maybe compete for the national championship and favorites for the ACC, but you see their talent level is not really higher than many of the coastal division teams in the ACC, and quite significantly lower than Florida State's. And South Carolina is even lower than Clemson, but, you know, coaching can make up for some of these things, but as far as talent level, you see that those teams aren't quite as high as one would think.
It's pretty interesting. So in terms of relative strength of various conferences, what have you found?
Well, certainly the SEC definitely has the most talent by quite a good margin over all the other conferences. After that, you pretty much have the Pac-12, the Big 12, and the ACC are all kind of right there together, and then another little bit of a drop down to the Big 10.
Okay. So that makes some sense, actually, based on what I've seen in terms of matches with what I'd expect in terms of my eyes. So a couple of those teams that you're sort of flagging for potentially surprising seasons then would be Auburn, Cal, Washington. Interesting that both Cal and Washington are in the same division, so that'll be interesting. Interesting, especially as bad as Auburn was last year, that, you know, it'll be interesting if they're able to challenge, you know, a team like Alabama or, you know, a couple of the bigger teams on their schedule, because, you know, a lot of people are basically writing them in as penning them in as automatic wins on those things. And, you know, just a little bit of resurgence could make things pretty interesting in the SEC there. So anyway, actually, let's flip it over to the SEC in terms of that. What really should we expect from the SEC this year? Are we going to get another SEC national champion based on what you're seeing? Or, you know, who should we expect to come out of the SEC? And what kinds of records are you coming around to?
Out of the SEC, I'm really looking at Georgia and Alabama rematch in the SEC championship. Those are, you know, the top two teams, as one would expect, in the SEC, in the rankings that I have compiled. As far as the national championship goes, it's just such a hard conference. And with teams like Auburn, teams like Tennessee, who has a bit higher than one would expect talent level, teams like Ole Miss, who have recruited well as of late, and Mississippi State, Texas A&M's entrance, and Missouri, who performed quite a bit lower than their talent level last year. So
yeah, they had a lot of injuries.
You have a lot of talent in the SEC, so expecting anything more than 10-2 out of really any SEC team is quite a good season, 10-2 this year for any SEC team. So, and with teams outside of the SEC that have a lot easier schedules and just as high as talent, you know, you would expect that, you know, Ohio State or Texas or Florida State or maybe even Southern California, one of those teams that have a much easier schedule than these SEC teams to do. You would expect one of those teams, or maybe even a Louisville or a Rutgers, if they can go undefeated, you know, to be those teams to be at 11-1 would surely get in over a 10-2 SEC team. So,
you know, of course, there is some debate about that, but that is interesting to think about. You know, this year, actually, it's one of the things that in the last few years that I've been looking at is the SEC is actually, and I guess Bob Stoops and a couple other Big 12 coaches brought that up in this offseason, that the SEC has been very, very strong at the top. But last year, the top six teams in the SEC went 30-0. Against the rest of the conference. And you know, that was brought up as a sort of example that the SEC's been pretty top heavy, and a lot of the teams sort of toward the bottom end have been more or less speed bumps for those top teams. And it sounds like what you're saying is that seems to have changed a little bit coming into this year, that the conference has gotten stronger. Sort of, there's been a self-fulfilling prophecy that has come out in recruiting, and it sounds like your ratings are kind of verifying that the conference has gotten stronger, and as a result, actually paradoxically, it means that some of those teams at the top might actually be less likely to win a title this year than they have in the past. So does that more or less sound like what you're coming to?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's just, you know, those middle to bottom tier teams, their talent levels have risen based on the success of the other SEC teams, you know, over the past 7-8 years. So now that their talent levels are higher, they will give more competition to those top, those elite teams in the SEC and make it harder for them to actually win more national championships.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And I mean, again, I guess that's how the sort of cyclical process, you know, at one point it was Florida State and Miami, and then, you know, you go to the Texas, Oklahomas and USC's, and then, you know, power's been in the SEC for a while. And, you know, I think it's sort of a paradoxical conclusion that actually one of the reasons that power may shift would be that a conference actually gets too strong across the board, and then you end up with too much parity to actually be able to dominate at the very top end. So it's sort of an interesting conclusion. And of course, Florida State this year, given their schedule, doesn't actually have to deal with that. So let's bring it around to of course, the topic of interest for most listeners, the primary topic of interest for most listeners of this particular podcast. Let's bring it around to what do you think we can really expect? What's a realistic expectation for Florida State this year? I know some people are considering it a rebuilding year because you've got a redshirt freshman quarterback. You lost a lot of players to the NFL draft. Would that be an accurate expectation, more or less, to expect a couple losses, a rebuilding year? What did you come to at the end of the day in your formula?
In my formula, a reasonable expectation would be somewhere around 10-2, 11-1. It was right in between 10 and 11 wins is what my formula came up with. So 10-2, 11-1 in the regular season, you know.
Which way did it tilt, more toward 10-2 or 11-1? That, of course, is of interest for those who, you know, are looking at a couple of the at whether or not you're looking at a conference title or not.
It was really almost dead even at right at 10.5. So, you know, it might have been just slightly towards 11, like 10-5-2, but it was almost dead even with 10-11. You know, and of course, just depends who that loss or those two losses are to. You know, if it's, you know, Clemson is one of those losses, then you could see us, you know, being even at 11-1 and outside looking into the ACC championship. However, still being able to get into a BCS bowl at 11-1. You know, if that's 11-1 at UF, obviously we're, you know, into the ACC championship and possibly in a BCS bowl. So,
yeah, so that I guess that does correlate with, you know, what a lot of people are expecting, where they're looking at this this as a more or less a 2-game schedule with Clemson and Florida. It sounds to me like what you had was actually Florida State being a favorite in Death Valley. Is that right?
Yeah, I really have Florida State being a favorite in every single game except for the away game at Florida.
Interesting. All right. Well, if that's the way it comes out, then you know what you said about Pitt being one of the better defenses. You know, you get past that game, and of course you have to win all the others. But you know, it could be a very interesting season. That wouldn't be considered a rebuilding year by any stretch. So
no, not at all.
And Clemson, I think, actually, you know, in my estimation, Clemson's actually kind of an interesting program because, you know, as hyped as they've been this offseason, I'm just not sure that they're going to be able to win more than 9 games this year given their schedule. So, you know, that's going to be an interesting one. I mean, they're opening with Georgia, who, as far as I can tell, is actually a little bit better across the board talent-wise than they are. But it is in Clemson, which, you know, they're about 2 touchdowns better in Death Valley, yep, or have been of late. So it's a very interesting game coming forward. And you know, if they don't win that one, then, you know, I think they're going to have some difficulty winning, you know, even getting the 10 game threshold this year, which, you know, obviously would be a disappointment for them. So, you know, especially given the expectations coming into the year, which, you know, everybody tends to overvalue things like the quarterback position and other places. But, you know, it could be very interesting in the ACC there. Who do you have in the Coastal Division?
I got really a 4-team race between North Carolina, Miami, Pittsburgh, and Virginia Tech, and even really Georgia Tech. You can't completely rule them out either. But out of that, I'm looking at North Carolina to come out of that and probably having a Florida State versus North Carolina ACC championship game.
Well, given their offense and Florida State's defense, that at least would be quite entertaining. So, yeah. We really thank you for coming on the program, Steve Pointer from SimplifiedFootball.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
So, in terms of expectations for Florida State this year, I think it's quite reasonable actually for fans to feel like 11-1 would be sort of a standard for a successful season. And better than that would, of course, be exceeding expectations. 10-2 would be slightly disappointing, but still not below expectations. So I think that's really where the expectations lie. And I do think that Florida State should be regarded as the favorite in the Atlantic Division and in the ACC in general. I mean, football is won on the line of scrimmage, and I don't think that there's a team in the country that's better on both lines of scrimmage than Florida State is. There are teams that may have a slightly better offensive line. There are a couple teams that may be better on the defensive line overall. I'm not sure I've seen any of those, particularly when you start to look at the depth situation. But I don't think that there's anybody who's better on both sides of the line of scrimmage than Florida State is. And obviously, everybody likes to look at the quarterback position. Everybody wants to see, you know, that fifth-year senior quarterback, and that's the year when you can really contend. But if you look at the recent past, some of the teams that have made the national title game or teams that have actually won titles, a number of those teams have been redshirt freshmen, you know, redshirt sophomores, not necessarily a lot of experience at quarterback, but usually a lot more experience on the offensive line and around the quarterback. Because again, this is something that, you know, Jimbo Fisher has said repeatedly, the quarterback's really only as good as the guys around him. If you're a quarterback and the receivers aren't running the right routes, then you're going to throw interceptions because those guys are in the wrong spots. But, you know, if those guys are consistently in the right spots, if your offensive line is consistently providing protection, if you've got a running game that can, you know, basically serve as a security blanket, if you've got, you know, a tight end who can provide that outlet over, you know, when you want to throw over the middle, if you've got backs who can catch in the flat, if you've got all that stuff around you and those guys are in the place that they should be, then you're going to be better than that fifth-year senior quarterback who's in a position like say Mike Glennon was in last year, where you're breaking in a whole host of players around you. Now, obviously, Glennon was able to get hot a couple times, in particular against Florida State, where that all clicked. But you can have that fifth-year guy and not be where you need to be elsewhere. I mean, EJ Manuel had some of that trouble last year. Christian Ponder, in particular, in 2010, had all sorts of problems with that, as there were only four wide receivers that they could really trust, and even those guys weren't always getting it right. And it doesn't make the quarterback look better. And so, essentially, you know, Jameis Winston has been handed the keys to a Ferrari here for this year's offense, and I really expect this offense to average over 40 points a game. Not because of the quarterback being necessarily spectacular. He doesn't need to be that for this offense to average that, you know, those kind of numbers against this schedule. All he really needs to do is manage the team, manage the offense well enough to allow the experienced talent around him to succeed. You know, basically, you know, you're handing the kid the keys and saying, don't crash it. And I think that's a lot of what's going on. And the defense, there's no question. You know, the depth chart was just released. The front seven on this defense is absurd. You know, with Dan Hicks lined up at the quote unquote Sam linebacker, essentially they released a 5-2 defensive alignment. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a future podcast. But basically, a 5-2 alignment in a way that could get them their best 11 on the field. It comes out as the same as a 4-3 under. I mean, there's all sorts of different ways you can talk about what they're doing there. But the bigger point is the average weight in the front seven, including the linebackers, is somewhere like 278 pounds. I mean, it's insane the size that Florida State can put out on the field, and then they can turn around and put seven defensive backs on the field, all of whom are going to, you know, have a chance to play on Sundays. So The defensive personnel is there. I think this year, as we talked about in the prior podcast, I think the schemes are there on defense. And I don't think that we're going to see a whole lot of busts on defense as the players adjust to this new system. And the experience and talent is certainly there on offense around the quarterback position. And that's what really matters. So realistically, I think that Florida State fans should expect and should think that this team has a very good chance, should feel that this team should win the ACC. Even though Clemson is there, as we heard from Steve, Clemson is perhaps maybe a little overrated going into the season. You know, people, again, they're looking at that fifth year senior quarterback. They're looking at Sammy Watkins. But Clemson lost. They lost an NFL tight end. They lost his backup to a torn ACL in the spring. You know, a guy who's going to really come in and be able to maybe fill those shoes. They lost a very good running back with great vision in Andre Ellington. Those are big losses. And then you add Nuke Hopkins, who they lost. And that's a huge loss. I know that, you know, they've got Sherrone Peak. They've got receivers that can play. But I really think that the biggest loss that Clemson has is at the tight end position on that offense. They really have had a guy, since Morris has been there, they've had a tight end who can set the edge in the running game and be a threat, basically be another wide receiver, in particular on third down, where they were one of the best in the country last year on third and long. Particularly on third down, they could be very good in the passing game, basically have another receiver out there. They could line that guy up and have a mismatch because of how well they could block the edge and get a receiving threat from that position. And they do not have that this year. I think we're going to see a lot more four wide looks from Clemson, which, to be quite honest, takes away some of what has made that offense so special. I think it's going to be a lot harder on Taj Boyd, when he doesn't have that extra security blanket of the tight end who can set the edge in the running game and, run like a receiver and a big receiver downfield in the passing game. So I think Clemson's actually going to have, you know, I think a nine win regular season for Clemson would be good this year. So a part of the reason that I think Florida State should finish 11-1 this year is that I just don't think that Clemson is quite as good as a lot of people are expecting coming into the year. And frankly, from the ACC's perspective, that may not be a good thing, in particular, with week one, them facing a very good, very talented, but young Georgia team. You know, if Georgia goes in and wins that game by two touchdowns or more, then, you know, all the statements about the ACC are going to come right back, and, you know, the ACC is weak, you know, all of these things are going to come into play, and that may be because Clemson, quite frankly, is just, they're not the best representative from the ACC the way that a lot of people think they are going into the season. That said, I do think that North Carolina is going to give South Carolina all they can handle on Thursday. So, you know, we'll see how that goes as well. That actually could be good for the ACC in terms of, I think if South Carolina is sort of very much like Clemson in that if they didn't have Jadeveon Clowney on that team, I'm not sure that team would be in the top 15. You're talking about a team that lost three of its top defensive linemen, its top five linebackers, its best defensive back from last year. They lost three of their top four receivers and four of their top five running backs. They lost their center. You're talking about a team that across the board is very young. They've got some talent, but I don't think they're nearly what people think they are. But Jadeveon Clowney has become the answer to any question about South Carolina this year. It's, well, you know, what, how are they going to replace? Well, they've got Jadeveon Clowney. Of course, he can play all three positions on the defensive line. They don't even need to put a defensive line out there other than him, right? So, you know, that's going to be an interesting one as well, because I think North Carolina is coming in a little bit under the radar, and I don't think South Carolina is quite as good as people expect. Now, they do have veteran quarterbacks, and they've got talent. They've got speed on the outside. They've got a good young back. They've got a huge and very physical offensive line, but I'm not sure that they're going to have enough to be able to stop North Carolina consistently, despite having, you know, Clowney and a few good pieces on defense. So, you know, that may actually help offset a little bit, if Georgia is able to really take it to Clemson. So, you know, we'll see exactly how that goes. You know, this is a very intriguing season going in, obviously. So, you know, either way, I think at any rate, Florida State should be regarded as the favorite going into the ACC this year, and I think fans have a reasonable expectation if they're feeling that way. I do not think that this is a rebuilding year for Florida State by any means. There's simply too much upper class talent on this team to really be approaching this season that way. On to the third segment of the program, we're going to take a look at the legend of Jimbo Fisher, the underachiever. And you haven't been able to read an article or see any commentary nationally about Florida State this offseason without somebody mentioning, well, you know, Florida State, they got a lot of talent, but you just can't trust them. You know, until Jimbo Fisher learns to win the games that he should, you just can't trust this team. You know, it's Florida State's just an underachieving program. And, you know, Fisher, you know, just he loses too many games that he should win, or, you know, this is an underachieving team. And that meme has even taken shape among Florida State fans themselves, where a lot of fans are basically saying, well, you know, Jimbo's done a good job building up the program, but, you know, you can't have bad losses like he has every year and continue to go this way. So, you know, I went back and took a look, you know, is this a fair criticism? Is this really something that, you know, should be a part of Jimbo Fisher's reputation? And, you know, when I started looking at it, let's think about this. You've got a coach who took over a proud program at a historic low. You know, this is a program that had won national championship. You know, it's a program that had gone 26-20 over the prior 4 years. It had gone actually, it's almost unbelievable, 15-17 mark in conference. And, you know, that first season, you know, you had a loss to one unranked opponent, both home and away. But you did get a 4-loss season, which was an improvement, and a convincing, you know, Peach Bowl or Chick-fil-A Bowl win. So, you know, that's progress in that first year. So, you know, the second season, you get a little bit better. 3 losses, conference title, BCS Bowl win. Things are getting better. And then that third season, you get a little step back as injuries, most notably at the quarterback position. You know, you get injuries at the quarterback position, and if you don't have depth there, you can be in trouble. You get, you know, that held some things back. You end up with 2 more losses to unranked opponents, both on the road. You get wound up with a disappointing 5-loss campaign. Now, what's amazing is that still through 3 years, you're looking at a 26-12 record, which is, you know, the same number of wins in 3 seasons than what you'd had in the prior 4 seasons before taking over. And that's 15-9 in conference as opposed to 15-17. Again, the same number of games won in conference as the prior 4 years. Now, this coach that I've been talking about actually is not Jimbo Fisher. That's Nick Saban at LSU. And as it turns out, Jimbo Fisher has done most of the same things. Jimbo Fisher took over at Florida State. Florida State had gone 31-21 in the 4 years prior. Just like Saban at LSU, Fisher won the same number of games, 31, in his first 3 years that had been won in the 4 prior seasons before his taking over. And frankly, they would have lost fewer. They would have lost more games. They wouldn't have won that many games had Fisher not been brought in as the offensive coordinator before he became the head coach. So here's where some of the parallels actually get really interesting. Saban at LSU lost to unranked opponents in each of his first 3 years. Now, this is something that the media keeps pointing to for Jimbo Fisher at this point and says, you know, well, Florida State just, they underachieve. They're always losing to that unranked team that they shouldn't. But so did LSU, and it's in Saban's first 3 years at LSU. Now, I think it would be absurd for anybody at this point, knowing what we know now, to suggest that Nick Saban was an underachiever. The fact was that LSU just didn't have the talent and depth built up at that point to not stumble on, you know, against a team that they should beat at some point during the year. You have to build the talent level. You have to build the program, build the consistency to get to that point. And frankly, Saban's first year had a worse loss than Fisher's ever had at Florida State. He lost 13-10 at home to UAB. And, you know, they lost to Louisiana Monroe in Birmingham in Saban's first year there at Alabama. I'm sorry, in Tuscaloosa. So, you know, you wind up looking at some of those losses. Saban actually had worse losses than any of the ones that Fisher's had. And then you think about that first campaign at LSU for Saban. They also lost to a 6-6 Arkansas team that was a train wreck. You look at Fisher's first year, he had last second loss at NC State on a fluke fumble where you know there's a play action and the back came too tight, and you remember Christian Ponder fumbled there. So last second loss at NC State on the road on a Thursday night, and then at home to a UNC team that had recovered almost all of the 12 players that it sent to the combine. That's a UNC team that really should have beaten LSU in the kickoff classic that game without most of its best players who had been suspended for that game as a result of Marvin Austin having a Twitter profile. So, you know, those are two actually, they look like worse losses than they were. I mean, NC State was quarterbacked by Russell Wilson. UNC was, you know, a good football team that year. They actually were a national title contender until they lost those players early in the year to suspension, and they were getting those guys back by the end of 2010. And then, you know, the injury-plagued second season for Fisher was more similar to Saban's third season, which was, a real step back. So Fisher had his step back in season two and then, you know, sort of broke through in season three. So each step has been forward. Saban went forward, then a step back, and then two steps forward. And then in the fourth season, Saban won the national championship. Very much like what you've got with Fisher. But if I've got a piece up on NoleDigest.com. It's a free piece about this that talks about exactly how unique Fisher's quote so-called penchant for bad losses actually is. And when you really break down these losses, you know, he's had a couple bad losses. Yes, that Virginia loss at home in 2011 was a bad loss. There's no question. That was a game that Florida State dominated three quarters, and you're not supposed to lose a game that you dominate for three quarters. And they did it again last year at NC State on the road, dominated the better part of three quarters and just couldn't put the game away. But again, those are two losses over the course of 3 years that you can really tag as bad. Saban actually had more than that in his first 3 years at LSU. So, you know, the proof is really in the pudding moving forward, as it's clear that at this point, Florida State's talent base has been built up. The program has been, as far as I'm concerned, the program has been completely turned around at this point. These kids, you got to realize, these freshmen, and I'll keep repeating this, these freshmen who are on this team had never seen Florida State win a title. I mean, they were 4 and 5 years old when Florida State last played for a national title. These kids had never seen Florida State win a championship in anything. And now, after last year, they got over the hump. Everybody on this team recognizes that Florida State should win championships. Not only are they a proud program with great history, but they know that not only can Florida State do that, but they've seen it done. They've done it themselves. And that getting over that hump is huge. It's just massive to be able to do that. So now I think the real interesting thing is going forward, you know, if the parallels hold out, then you know, if Florida State gets some of the breaks that LSU did in Saban's fourth year, then this could be a shockingly good campaign for Florida State. But the bottom line is that I don't think that those parallels are coincidental. The same basic structure of the program that Saban put in place at LSU has been put in place at Florida State, and you're seeing the same step-by-step incremental improvement. And, you know, a good way to talk about that incremental improvement is how Florida State, in 2009, Florida State was ranked 42nd in the Football Outsiders F-plus ratings. Fisher's first year, they went to 18th. Second year, they went to 10th. Even though they had a worse record and they had all those injuries, they still improved in terms of their overall consistency over the course of the year. And then they were 5th in 2012. So each year, they've taken a good step forward. If they continue that trend this year, then you're looking at a team that really does put itself right in the thick of a hunt for the national title. Now, I think Fisher's actually suffered a little bit for having been a head coach in waiting before he actually took over. A lot of people basically think of Fisher as having been at Florida State a lot longer than he actually has been in, as far as the head coach. He's not been in charge but 3 years. But, you know, people remember him at Florida State all the way back to 2007. So essentially the connection is that, wow, Florida State's been underachieving for a really long time. But the fact is that those teams pre-2010 were really not nearly as talented as people thought. I mean, a lot of those high profile prospects that were, you know, leading to the major recruiting rankings and that sort of thing, those guys never made it to campus. It's been one of the biggest changes actually that's happened since Fisher got to the head coaching job has been better evaluation of players who are going to actually stick in the program. So that recruiting rankings are actually more indicative of the actual guys that you're going to be putting on the field 2 years later. And that was something that was a major problem actually in those final years. I mean, I remember going down on the, I was on the field for the 2009 on the sidelines for the 2009 Wake game. And I keep saying this, Wake Forest was more talented than Florida State in that game. That was not an upset. Wake Forest was better. They had better personnel than Florida State did in that 2009 game. As amazing as that is for those two programs. But at any rate, I think Fisher suffers for that, and I also think he suffers by comparison to what Saban has done at Alabama and the run of consistency that Alabama's had. But even Saban has had trouble at Alabama at times. I mean, his best team was that 2010 team that did not win the national title. They lost three games and were not nearly as consistent as they could have been. But, you know, he still thinks, Saban still says that that was probably the best team that he had, that he has had at Alabama. So anyway, when you compare Fisher to what went before at LSU, what Saban did at LSU, then Fisher actually looks pretty darn good. And there aren't very many coaches who've pulled off what Fisher has done so far in terms of turning around a major power so quickly. Now, in the next podcast, we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to talk a lot about Pitt. And we're going to talk about this first game. It's a game that, as optimistic as I think Florida State fans should be going into this season, I think this is a game that there should be a lot of caution about. This is a game that I think Florida State's going to have a little more trouble scoring. It's one of the better defenses that they're going to play, and you know we're going to see a lot about this Florida State team, about how well they're going to fight. If they go in and they blow Pitt out, then you know I think it's time for Florida State fans to realize that this is really a national title contender. But, you know, I'm not necessarily expecting that. I think Florida State fans should be very cautious, should not expect too much in this first game. I think this is a team that should grow over the course of the year. But and this game is going to be a real challenge for them with how these matchups stack up. But we'll talk a little bit more about that, actually a lot more about that, in the next podcast. But for now, thanks to Steve Pointer from SimplifiedFootball.com for joining us. I'm Jason Staples, and this has been the Unconquered Podcast. I made this.